Hey, Houston. Thank you for tuning in to another week at the Houston Indie Media Show. Tonight, we will bring you coverage from the ongoing struggle regarding the recently passed anti-feeding ordinance from our own Nick Cooper, and also some coverage of the Occupy Houston / Austin movement and some of the felony charges that the members are facing as a result of their nonviolent civil disobedience action at the Houston Ship Channel several months back. But of course, as you know, we are about to tune in to another 2 weeks of Pledge Drive. Pledge Drive is a very important event in which you are able to put your money where your ears are. If you tune into us every week, or maybe if you're tuning into us for the very first time, or another show on KPFT or any show on KPFT, of course, we are a listener sponsor, volunteer run collective, and we need your support. Venetia, why don't you talk a little bit more about that?
We're all volunteer collective. All of us come in here every week to, we're all volunteers. We focus on not mainstream media covered topics, such as I have this announcement right now for the normal marijuana march that is occurring tomorrow. The Houston chapter of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML, in conjunction with other chapters from around the state, will be making the annual march to the Capitol in Austin to demand change in our marijuana laws. The march will start at noon from Austin City Hall on Cesar Chavez and march down towards Congress. The march will rally at the Capitol from 1 to 3 p.m. with speakers including Josh Schimberg from Texas Normal, Dr. Kenneth Hendrickson from Sam Houston State. There will also be music and more. The theme for the day is regulate marijuana like alcohol. If you need a ride, please call Houston Normal President Steve Nolan at 713-688-6022. And they will be leaving about 8 a.m. tomorrow, which is Saturday. And that's one of the topics that we typically cover on this show, is things that are not covered by mainstream media, like this marijuana march, among other things, like the Austin activist that will be facing felony charges. That's not something that you hear regularly on the news, because that's something that is trying to be hidden from you, really.
And in terms of pitching, of course, you can go to kpft.org. There's always the pitch jar. You can go ahead and make your contribution in advance. Of course, the more of you that choose to do so tonight, that means the more live grassroots media we're able to bring you over the next 2 weeks, and the less we have to harass you or beg you or whatever adjective or verb you want to use to try to get you to give us money. And also, you can go to 713-526-5738. That's 713-JAM-KPFT. Of course, no one is staffing the phones right now, but we are always located in the heart of the Montrose on Lovett Boulevard. John, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the only thing I would want to mention is the fact that I think by now most people know that the station has incurred some additional expenses given the weather that we've had and its effect on the station. So what we're looking at is a little bit more that we're going to need to raise. You know, whether or not it's in our goal or not, or whether or not it's part of the fund goal, we have to work a little bit harder this time so that we can do our share in terms of trying to help with the cost that is incurred because of the lightning strikes that we've had.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say, was that the antenna has been struck by lightning. So
right.
We're running on like minimum power right now, whatever. A lot of people aren't getting.
Yeah, we're not even at full power. And that's right. And I think that when you stop and think about that, you know, how many folks are not able to listen to the station, and not just our show, but all the shows.
That's one of the things that Rachel brought up to me when I first started the show, was that the cool thing about indie media radio is that everyone has access to radio. You know, not everyone can go online and listen to, like, the live stream and stuff. So we really need the antenna up and
right.
running. And also, like I said earlier, we're all volunteers, so we're not getting paid for this. Any money that you donate is going to go to the station. It's going to go to making sure that you hear us loud and clear, hear our independent news.
Exactly.
And very good. And speaking of independent news and coverage that isn't heard anywhere else, we have Ronnie on the phone right now from Austin Indy Media. Of course, the Occupy Austin movement. Several months ago, of course, beginning with Occupy Wall Street, the Occupy movement spread in a way that even those of us that are grassroots media folks or activists perhaps could not anticipate. It spread like wildfire across the country. The embers continue to burn. One of the biggest actions was at the Houston Ship Channel, which was an answer to a national call to shut down ship channels like what happened here in Houston. We currently have several activists, Texas-based activists, that are facing some rather serious charges. We have Ronnie on the phone once again from Occupy Austin to speak about some of those charges. Ronnie, are you there?
Yes, right here.
Excellent. Now, for people who maybe don't know about the attempt to shut down the Houston Ship Channel as part of the coordinated Occupy movement action several months back, I believe it was 2 months back, can you take us to that day and also the planning and national coordination leading up to that day?
Sure. So it was December the 12th, and the call came out from California. Specifically, it was related to the ILWU, International Longshoremen Workers Union, out in California. They were protesting a number of things related to EGT. That was the company that they were unable to sort of make any headway with. So the occupiers out in California, specifically Oakland, San Francisco, and along that West Coast area, called for a blockage of the port. And around the nation, there were a number of solidarity actions. So there was a solidarity action in New York, in Boston, and in Houston, because it was a different union in Houston, but it was a solidarity action with what was happening on the West Coast. So there was a lot of coordination. We have sort of inter-Occupy network, is the best way to describe it, that had been planning for several weeks up until that date to try and coordinate actions around the country to support what was happening in California, and that's what resulted in the Houston action that we had on December the 12th. It wasn't a full shutdown of the port. The Houston port is one of the largest in the nation, if not the largest, and so it was going to be impossible for us to actually shut down the whole port. But what we decided to do was to block a road symbolically. So that way we could stand in solidarity with what was happening in California.
And now a few hundred protesters gathered that day at the port for the symbolic action, but a handful of Austin activists actually locked down. Share a bit about the history behind this type of nonviolent direct action disobedience.
Sure. It actually was not just Austin occupiers. There were occupiers from Dallas and Houston who also locked down. So there were 7 people in total who locked down. There were 20 people in total who were arrested. So there were several lines along the road, along this sort of access road near the headquarters of the port, and 7 of us. And it was between Austin, Houston, and Dallas, blocked that area with these pipes. It was it was designed to essentially do the same thing that the rest of the folks were doing, just blocking the way. And the purpose was simply to show our solidarity with California, and there was a number of folks. There were many folks who were involved throughout Texas who planned the action and plan the actual trip out to Houston within Texas to do that action. In terms of the history of that kind, specifically that kind of blockage, it's really mixed because it depends on the local law. It depends on the state law of that particular state as to those kinds of actions and the kinds of repercussions that result. For us, the Houston DA and the rest of the folks involved with the prosecution, they're using an old Texas law that was originally used against the movie Deep Throat, as kind of, you know, ironically, as that might be, it was a movie that was being shown through a projector, and the projector itself was what was considered the criminal device.
Okay, and, so you're referencing 70s porn to a lockdown of the ship channel. Can you give us a little bit more background on that as to how you make that jump?
Well, that's what he was saying. I think the projector, and
yeah,
then you had the tubing.
It was specifically the projector. That was the criminal device that set the precedent for this law, and it's a fairly obscure law. There's a number of folks from the National Lawyers Guild who are helping represent everyone who was arrested that day, and in their experience, this has been used a few times with protesters, but it originated from that movie, and it's meant to stop a crime as far as the probable cause goes. And the mainstream media did report on that, and they reported on the fact that the judge did dismiss the charges originally. She ruled that there was no probable cause for the charges because it didn't meet the criteria. The law is meant to stop a crime. It's meant to prevent a crime from that specific instrument. That specific instrument has to be used to commit the crime. And they're really kind of stretching it. What we understand is they're trying to set a new type of precedent that goes beyond what the original intent was, because they actually are trying to amplify the crime rather than prevent the crime. And the crime is not you don't need pipes to block a road, because there were a number of other folks who got arrested simply by locking arms. So it's not the type of crime that is you need those devices, but those devices were used, and so it appears that the district attorney is promoting the amplification of the crime through the use of these instruments, and it's a new type of thing. It's a new type of interpretation of that law.
But civil disobedience should not be a crime, anyways.
Well, it was simply a demonstration, and nonviolent as far as that goes.
And speaking of that, for those that watched the corporate news coverage across the state, or even those that checked it out later on YouTube, the Texas activists that were using the PVC pipes to lock down were subjected to an orange tent that obstructed the view from observers and the media. Do you have any insight into exactly what happened under that orange tent?
Right. So when we got out, we found the news articles and other stories that were running in the media. It appears that the Houston Fire Department and Police Department were promoting the idea that the tent was used specifically to prevent essentially a fire or prevent harm to the bystanders, because the story that was put out in the Houston Chronicle and on ABC was that a device was used to cut through the pipes to actually release us, which is inaccurate. That's not true. There was no cutting of the pipe at all. There was a bolt that ran through the pipe, so they used a bolt cutter and snipped it. So they just snipped the bolt and pulled it out, and then everyone was able to be released from those pipes. So their story was that we need the tent to protect in case of sparks or bystanders, to prevent any harm or a fire that might result as a result of this cutting. But there was no cutting. So they put the tent over us, snipped the bolts, and that was that. But tragically, they also used the tents over the people that were just locking arms. There were no pipes whatsoever involved in that flank of the protest, but they still felt the need to cover people as they were arresting them and separating them. So nothing of the sort in terms of sparks or cutting happened under the tent.
Was there any police brutality?
Well, early on, there was there were a number of folks who were linking arms with the people who had pipes. So it was sort of a long line, and there were seven folks with pipes, and then there were a few other folks who were linking arms at the ends of those pipes. And when they started separating people, the police came in, and they were using alarming tactics. They were putting their fingers up the nose of one of the protesters and just pulling back, so that way, through the pain he might release, they were going after the fingers. So when that happened, there were a number of people who were standing by before the tent was placed over us who saw that and were trying to record it. And we're being kept back. So that was the start of the arrests and the separations. They were actually putting the fingers up the nose of protesters and going after the fingers and kind of really manhandling a number of the people involved.
Okay, now we only have about 2 minutes left. Can you maybe talk a little bit about those Texas activists that continue to face felony charges as a result of their nonviolent direct action civil disobedience? When are they due back in court? Excuse me. How can we support them, and where can we get more information?
Well, we're due back in court on June the 18th. That is when the first trials are supposed to start. There will be three of us that will be facing trial by jury on June the 18th. The charges that we're facing are up to 2 years in jail. that's sort of the maximum penalty. There's a potential of a fine involved as well, but the folks involved with the felonies are looking at about 2 years in jail, and then being charged with a felony in relation to a nonviolent civil disobedience protest. You can find more information by contacting people out at Occupy Houston and Occupy Austin. You can email info@OccupyAustin. You can go to the Occupy Houston website, OccupyHouston.org, and contact them as well. So we'll be going through that trial on the 18th, and then there will be more trials to follow after that. We'll see exactly what comes of the trial on the 18th.
Okay, thank you so much, Ronnie, for joining us. Once again, that's June 18th. And do you have an address for where the trial will be taking place for those that perhaps want to take signs or banners or in any way want to show their solidarity right there on the ground?
Well, it's going to be at the main courthouse in Houston. Unfortunately, I actually don't know the address, but
it's right next to Tranquility Park.
Find
that.
Well, I'm sorry? What was that?
It's well, there's a complex of courthouses down the north end of downtown, but it's at the main criminal courthouse, and that's where more than likely the trial will be.
Right, it's the main criminal courthouse
right.
on Court 248.
Okay, thank you, Ronnie, and we'll keep following the story.
Okay, thank you so much.
Homelessness or a War on the Homeless by Nick Cooper, excerpted from Free Press Houston. On March 2nd, Hank Rush, the CEO of Houston's Star of Hope Mission, who makes $250,000 a year salary for his work with the poor, joined several other homeless service leaders in signing a commentary in the Houston Chronicle. They gave their support to a new law that would impose $2,000 fines on unpaid volunteers for sharing home-cooked food with the needy in public, going so far as to criminalize bringing a box of fruit into one's house to keep it out of a hot car for a few hours before going to share it. The law would have been laughable if it weren't a threat to the food supply of a vulnerable population. Wondering why homeless service providers might consider supporting a law that was so potentially devastating to Houston's homeless population, activists began researching Star of Hope. The first news item that came up was that Mayor Anise Parker had announced a massive public-private partnership with the Star of Hope just 4 days before the commentary was published. $3 million initially and $1.5 million per year thereafter was planned for a sobering center for people found drunk in public. Touted as a cheaper and less punitive alternative to incarceration, the project would benefit Rush and other signatories to the commentary. The mayor said, quote, "I perceive this ordinance as trying to balance the rights and needs of different groups of people." Apparently for her, the homeless are the ones holding the upper hand in this imbalance and the victims that downtown business owners require the city's emergency help. The need of property owners is being trampled by the need of the homeless to eat, sleep, and excrete. She compelled the city to act urgently to control trash and excrement, not by putting out more receptacles and toilets, but by policing the food supply. Massive backlash from volunteers of all stripes forced the mayor to change the law, stripping it of important details. It no longer explicitly criminalized things like the sharing of homemade food, but since the process for obtaining permission was never disclosed, it was anyone's guess what the criteria she or subsequent mayors might choose to use for granting permission. Homemade food might be illegal, it might not. It just depended on the unwritten criteria of whatever agency has the job of granting permission. The new version of the law temporarily hid the most egregious details, and the mayor falsely and unilaterally declared that a compromise had been struck. We got to stop. When their turn came to speak, the homeless opened up their hearts to a city council that had probably already made up their minds. 58-year-old James Lira told city council, "If it weren't for these truly gracious people, I would not eat." Maurice Samuel O'Neill, who identified as being on and off the streets for the last 40 years, said, "When has America stopped being the land of the free and the home of the brave and become the land of the oppressed and the home of the economic slave?" Many in the audience were affected hearing the comparison to slavery by an older, southern, African-American man. The most devastating critiques of the mayor's proposed law came from the kids. One asked, "Mayor Parker, did you eat breakfast this morning? Did you have to get permission from the city?" Requiring permission for groups to serve has precedent. In San Francisco in 1988, the permit requirement was used to criminalize and arrest hundreds of food-sharing volunteers. The mayor then, like Anise Parker now, described the process as easy, but that was not the experience of volunteers in San Francisco. Keith McHenry, the co-founder of the Food Not Bombs movement, says, "It was clear that the purpose of the permit process was to make it impossible for Food Not Bombs to share food and information in public." Star of Hope wasn't the only agency to benefit from the new funding and wasn't the only organization whose leader signed on to the Houston Chronicle commentary to support the original, extremely draconian version of the law. The Coalition for the Homeless is at the center of an influx of cash to Houston that is so big that it makes the millions involved in the sobering center look like chump change. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, channels $1.5 billion a year into programs and nonprofits. This month, Houston and eight other cities with large homeless populations will begin getting big Obama dollars for the express purpose of ending homelessness in a few years through rapid rehousing. To kick off the program, the Coalition for the Homeless launched a series of breakfasts for Houston's homeless providers. Titled, Take Your Seat at the Table, the participants were welcome to carve their pieces of the pie of all this funding coming to Houston. Participants in the breakfast were told that along with the money comes an entirely new system. Houston's homeless services are being rapidly transformed into a system with centralized intake for all homeless, a new authority that links funding to performance evaluations, and a constantly expanding database called the Homeless Management Information System, or HMIS. Shockingly, the underwriter for the first of these two Coalition for the Homeless breakfasts was Brookfield Office Properties, which owns 12 skyscrapers downtown. Paul Lane, the regional head for Brookfield Properties Houston's operation, also sits on the board of directors for the Coalition for the Homeless. As the largest commercial real estate owner in Houston's downtown, Brookfield is notorious for its central role in perpetuating the below-poverty wages among downtown custodial workers who make an average of $8,600 a year. Brookfield also happens to own Zuccotti Park, where Occupy Wall Street activists were encamped for months. The park is named for Brookfield co-chairman Johnny Zuccotti. In October, Brookfield wrote to New York Police Commissioner Kelly demanding the eviction of the activists. The connection seemed to confirm the suspicions of many involved with Occupy Houston that this law was intended to target them. Ray Hill, longtime activist and Democratic state candidate, said, "This whole issue may have never been about feeding the homeless. It may have been about shutting down the Occupy movement, which has done more than anything to put a light on the injustices and excesses of big business greed." Many Houston activists who assume that Brookfield doesn't value the needs of the homeless any more than the custodians working in their own buildings are outraged to discover their participation in Coalition for the Homeless programs. Food Not Bombs volunteers like myself sit in these meetings a bit baffled. On July 1st, our volunteer work in the streets of Houston, along with the work of dozens of other organizations, will be a crime. We don't have salaries, budgets, or pieces of the pie. We don't need money, bureaucracy, and we certainly don't need to be permitted. We do want to see homelessness eliminated, but not by punitive measures. Food Not Bombs was the first group sharing food with the homeless after Ike, Rita, and Katrina. FEMA referred people to us. If this law is enacted in July, and by late August a hurricane comes through, even under emergency conditions, it will still be a crime for us to go out and share food. Even if police were willing to look the other way during a hurricane aftermath, we might no longer have the intact relationships, food supply, and internal structure to resume our operations after months of being criminalized. We rely on an influx of new high school volunteers, and parents might think twice about having their children participate in a group that might be illegal. Making volunteerism a crime will damage Houston's infrastructure. Volunteers are a vital part of a system that helps nourish a vulnerable population that without our efforts would turn increasingly to shoplifting, dumpster diving, and panhandling. There are over 60 local groups speaking out against these laws. From the conservative Houston Area Pastors Council to the Catholic Worker Movement, from Occupy Houston to the Tea Party, from the Harris County Republican Party to the Green Party, from the Nation of Islam to the Hare Krishnas, the diversity of this loose coalition may well be unprecedented. Come join and volunteer with Food Not Bombs. We're downtown in front of the library, four nights a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 8 p.m., Sundays at 7 p.m., in front of the downtown public library, 521 Lamar Street.
So we have a few quick reminders before we leave y'all this week. This weekend is the Sustainability Fest at Market Square. For more information on that, you can check out our Facebook page.
National League for Peace and Freedom will sponsor the 12th annual Peace Camp to be held July 23rd through the 27th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The location is the Cameron Retreat Center, located at 2403 Holcomb Boulevard. The camp's mission is to provide an alternate day camp experience for children 5 to 11 years old, which fosters an understanding of peace, justice, and respect. This year's theme will be courage. For additional information, visit the website peacecamp.com.